You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. So my name is Marty West, and I'm an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and also a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings. And it's an honor to be here to welcome you to today's discussion of non-cognitive skills and their implications for education policy. I want to begin by briefly addressing the most common feedback or criticism I received when planning this event, and to make things absolutely clear, I don't much like the term non-cognitive skills either. I'm aware that it's a misnomer, that every psychological trait is cognitive in the sense that it relies on the processing of information of some kind. The term's emergence simply reflects the historical fact that the term cognitive was appropriated early on to refer to intellectual abilities and subject matter achievement, making everything else that's not directly measured by tests of intellectual ability and subject matter achievement non-cognitive by default. But given this fact, the situation we find ourselves in, I tend to agree with former director of the Institute of Education Sciences, John Easton, who recently said, "Everybody hates this term, but everyone knows roughly what you mean when you use it, and no one has a much better alternative." And I think the fact that we have a full room here today in Falk Auditorium and lots of people watching the event online suggests that he's right. So we'll surely return to the labeling issues later, but my hope is that we won't today get bogged down in semantics, because the substantive issues at stake are too important. The evidence is overwhelming that whatever they're called, skills beyond those captured by test scores play a critical role in supporting student success in school and in life. Gaps in those skills appear to play a key role in explaining the differences in access to opportunity that are rightly the focus of so much policy attention at present. I say this not to disparage test scores, which remain the best short-term proxy for long-term student success, but it's increasingly clear that test scores don't tell us everything we want to know. And it's also clear that educators know this and are devoting considerable energy to developing students' non-cognitive skills, but they're doing so largely without the benefit of an organizing policy framework. So the question before us today is, how, if at all, should policymakers at the state, local, and federal level respond to this situation? What would it mean to incorporate non-cognitive skills into education policy? And these are hard questions, which is why I'm gladly mainly to be asking questions today rather than answering them, and that we have such a distinguished panel of practitioners to help us think them through. We've built the event mainly around presentations from two organizations that, in very different ways, stand out due to their coordinated, structured approaches to developing students' non-cognitive skills. First, the CORE districts, which I used to thought was the California Office to Reform Education, but I've learned is now an acronym that's no longer an acronym. The CORE districts is a partnership of 10 districts in California that collectively serve more than 1 million students. CORE received a waiver from the federal government to develop a school accountability system that explicitly incorporates measures of social and emotional learning. Rick Miller, the executive director of CORE and a former deputy superintendent of the California Department of Education, will share what they've learned so far. Broadening accountability systems is one way to broaden the definition of school success. Another one that may be particularly attractive when it comes to difficult to measure constructs like non-cognitive skills is to rely on market forces. And it's interesting to note that many of the schools that are leading in this space that are being most innovative are in fact charter schools, many of the no excuses variety. So we're very glad to be joined also by Richard Barth, the CEO of the KIPP Foundation, who will share how his network of 162 schools seeks to track the development of its students' character. Before that, though, we have the privilege to hear from Chris Gabrielli. Chris Gabrielli is a successful healthcare entrepreneur who since has turned his entrepreneurial energies into the field of education. He's been the founder of numerous organizations, including the National Center for Time on Time and Learning, and Transforming Education, the work of which he'll talk with us about today. I should also say that Chris was recently appointed by Republican Governor of Massachusetts Charlie Baker to be the chair of the Massachusetts Board of Higher Education. The fact that he received that appointment, despite the fact that he himself was a former Democratic candidate for governor in the state, I think tells us something about his non-cognitive abilities. So I think he's well equipped to kick off the discussion. So without further ado, I'll turn things over to Chris.
Thanks for that kind introduction, Marty. I guess flim-flammery, political flim-flammery is now a non-cognitive competency. Good morning. On behalf of all of my colleagues at Transforming Education, several of whom are here with me today, we thank Brookings for the opportunity to participate. So while the title of today's event is Ready to be Counted? My job is largely to make the case that the answer is Ready to be Counted? To do that, I am to share a little data and our thinking around two propositions. First, that there is ample and compelling evidence that non-cognitive skills predict and influence success in academics, for careers and incomes, and in life well-being. In light of that, surely schools and education systems must incorporate explicit and effective strategies to help ensure students gain these vital skills. Second, that far from being yet another potential add-on to existing work being done by educators, the evidence is that there's already a huge amount being done and spent on these skills by teachers and schools, generally under the rubric of social-emotional learning. So new and better policy is needed to bring more order and effectiveness to existing investments. By way of brief background on our organization, Transforming Education, we are a Boston-based nonprofit that works at the intersection of education and psychological science in order to try to build effective education policies and practices that can equip students with the full range of skills they need to succeed. We are the strategic advisor to education systems serving more than a million students. As part of that, we're fortunate to work with both CORE and KIPP in Massachusetts, and you'll hear from both of them later. We're also active in partnerships that generate scholarship in this field, often in partnership with Marty West and his colleagues, as well as our National Scientific Advisory Board that includes many of the leaders in this field, such as Carol Dweck and Angela Duckworth. Now, some of you may recognize the Tower of Babel on this slide, either artistically, as the 16th century painting by Bruegel, or perhaps as the contemporary cacophony of overlapping terminology in this field, such as social-emotional skills, character, soft skills, 21st century skills, mindsets, EQ, and so on. Many of us find the National Academy of Sciences framework to be a helpful way to organize this disparate terminology. It labels two large clusters of competencies outside the cognitive area as intrapersonal and interpersonal. Thus, one large domain addresses how we manage ourselves, while the other covers how we interact with other people. We use a further term at Transforming Education for the subset of intrapersonal and interpersonal skills that are most ripe for use in schools. The term is MESH, short for Mindsets and Essential Skills and Habits. Our argument is that for this field to become practical for schools, we need to sift the many identified competencies through three filters, which we call the three M's. Which skills are meaningful in that they significantly impact student success, which ones are practically measurable in school settings, and finally, which are malleable through the effort of schools and teachers. The subset of skills that reasonably meet these criteria we label MESH skills. For example, working with our colleagues at CORE and the CORE districts, they have selected four such competencies on which to initially focus. The evidence in this field can be organized around three high-level goals: success in academics, in career, and later in life. Later this spring, we will be releasing a working paper for this field aimed at highlighting a range of compelling evidence, but for today, we only have time for a snapshot. To start with academic success, we can point to evidence such as from the Dunedin Longitudinal Study on Self-Management, where those with high self-control in their early years went on to graduate high school at a 95% rate versus only 58% for those low in self-control. Carmet Siegel's work on self-management showed those low in self-control in eighth grade were three times less likely to graduate college. And in our own work with Marty West, we showed that growth mindset is a significant predictor of test score value-added gains from fourth grade to eighth grade in Boston. In career success, we are compelled by James Heckman's findings on the NLSY longitudinal data set that for adult employment, adolescent non-cognitives were more predictive than cognitive measures. In the Dunedin study, those high in self-control in youth were four times more likely to be earning at least $2,000 per month as adults than those low in self-control. And when you ask employers, as Northeastern researchers did recently, all five of the top skills sought among college graduates were non-cognitive ones, such as work ethic and teamwork. Finally, when looking at life well-being, Dunedin shows 13% of high self-control kids ending up with adult criminal convictions, far less than the 43% for their low-control peers. In Walter Mischel's famous marshmallow test of delayed gratification, each minute a four-year-old could wait longer predicted a 0.2 decrease in their adult body mass index. Some people think it's obvious if you don't eat the marshmallow, you're thinner, but it's subtler than that. And in the famous Perry preschool trial, the rate of becoming a single parent dropped from 83% in the control group to 57% among those who received the intervention. We don't have time to go into detail on any or all of this evidence, but I do want to give you just a quick sense of the depth and quality of the studies underlying the evidence I just summarized. To begin with, I cited the Dunedin study for all three areas of success. That's an extraordinary study over the past 40 years where nearly every child born in the New Zealand village of Dunedin in 1972 has been followed longitudinally. After sifting through all the data, three childhood risk factors explain a great deal of long-term outcomes: IQ, SES, and self-control. What Dunedin allows us to see is the incredible importance of self-control in children even after controlling for IQ and SES. We see how low self-control children get caught in adolescent snares, such as smoking, dropping out, and getting pregnant, and how over the long term, self-control is a major factor in predicting a wide range of adult outcomes. This busy slide shows a number of key outcomes in health and wealth among that Dunedin cohort, now in their late 30s, mapped against their childhood levels of self-control. As you can see, the gradient of self-control in youth highly correlates to adult outcomes such as physical health, substance dependence, income, and savings. Here is a 3D data depiction by Nobel Prize economist James Heckman looking at probabilities of gaining a college degree by age 30 among men. As you can see, the decile level of cognitive and non-cognitive predictors are approximately equally important. Neither alone is sufficient to ensure college graduation. Here are long-term outcomes from Perry preschool study. In a wide variety of intermediate and long-term outcomes, the program recipients do better than the control group. While the cognitive measure of IQ showed a major gain at age 5, all of that disappeared by third grade, what is known as the fade-out effect. This means that the long-term positive outcomes are likely attributable to the sustained non-cognitive advantages. While the previous slides have focused more on our criterion of whether these skills are meaningful in terms of long-term outcomes, Perry preschool also is important for showing that the skills are malleable, in that case at age 4. Here we show an important recent trial of the Tools of the Mind curriculum, which targets executive function, a key driver of self-control and other skills. As you can see, the intervention aligns with the increasing gains in reading. Turning to interventions at the middle school level, Carol Dweck's work on growth mindset shows here the ability to halt and even reverse the normal decline in math achievement among the intervention group. Finally, Raj Chetty's recent analysis of the long-term data arising from the famous Tennessee Star study shows that high-quality kindergarten imparts impressive economic value to students. Interestingly, the analysis also shows that the benefit of high-quality kindergarten fades when it's measured through test scores, but continues when it's measured through non-cognitive skills, suggesting it is the non-cognitive skills that drove the adult economic benefits. Hopefully, this drive-by data dump helps convince you that non-cognitive skills matter. Whether you agree or not, this slide shows you teachers sure think they do. In national surveys of teachers, you can see that over 90% think social-emotional skills are important and teachable, and nearly every single one has at least some students who need SEL help, and 88% say there is some SEL programming already at their schools. Transforming Education's second working paper out later this spring dives deeper into the question of what all of these schools and teachers are already doing. In our ongoing survey work, we are seeing interesting differences in the motivations. While district leaders have lofty goals such as, quote unquote, a more well-rounded education and more engaged citizens, principals' top-cited reason is academic performance, and teachers' top reason, classroom behavior management, seems fairly instrumental. So demand is high. What's the supply? It's important to realize that there are some very large programming efforts in the United States today. Avid has been around for decades and is in more than 4,800 schools. Second Step, another multifaceted curricular and professional development approach, is in 25,000 schools. And Responsive Classroom claims to have trained 65,000 teachers over the past 20 years. Most recently, the free downloadable app called Class Dojo, which allows teachers to immediately assign points for behavior during classes, say they've been downloaded by at least one teacher in half of all American schools and have interacted with 35 million teachers, students, and parents. And because all of you have been doing such a fine job listening to us this morning, I'm awarding all of you a point now. Finally, we are working to quantify how much is being invested into non-cognitive skill development already. On direct spending, hard dollars spent on materials or training, we are currently yielding a mid-range point estimate of $640 million per year. And when it comes to considering the allocation of time, a tremendously precious resource for teachers and schools, we're getting an estimate of about 4 hours and 20 minutes a week of teacher time, about 10% of all of their time. The majority of that, more than half an hour a day, is classroom instructional time, and another 90 minutes a week is in prep time. We want to provide a monetary estimate for all that teacher time, and depending on which cost allocation model we choose, our preliminary estimate is in the range of $30 billion of our nation's total annual spend on K-12 education is already being allocated to SEL activities. So I hope you feel that this presentation has helped shift the question mark to an exclamation point when it comes to the importance of non-cognitive skills for education policy. These competencies matter greatly to student success, and they are already the subject of large-scale investment. We think the time is here to move beyond discussing whether these competencies should be incorporated into education policy and instead to focus on how. Now I'd like to turn it over to Rick Miller, who can share an example of how seven districts in California have done just that.
Thanks, Chris. Morning, everybody. So let me begin telling a little about core and core districts. So core districts represents over a million students in California, 10 mostly large districts across the state. 8 of the 10 largest districts in California are part of our network. And you can see the districts here. We have a waiver from ESEA, so we are unique in that we are the only non-state waiver a set of districts. So in California, California's state decided not to apply for a waiver. The federal government allowed the core districts to come in and get a waiver. And so that's what we're going to sort of talk about today is that waiver. So what I want to first start with is when we began this conversation thinking about what we wanted to put in our waiver and what we wanted to make as part of our accountability model, we started with collecting the dashboards of the districts across our state, across our network. The theory being whatever they are paying attention to is what we want to start with. And it was an important way to go into this work was it was less about what we sort of want to make sure we're accountable for and sort of hammering on and more about what do we value, what are the sort of the right drivers to move our systems in the direction we want to go, and then how can we incorporate them. And early on, a decision that SEL was a large part of that made a lot of sense to us. We had a couple districts that were in the Castle districts that were working on these issues, but across the board, most of our districts hadn't engaged in these issues, but felt that it was going to be an important part of what we did. So we sort of put our sort of three things in front as we moved our accountability model. One was this moral imperative of we have to do what's right for all the kids in all of our network, and what does an accountability look like to do that? Secondly, how do we share accountability? So our the way we hold ourselves accountable is actually through a peer review process. So we actually don't have a SCA looking into us, looking at whether we're doing what we want, but actually holding each other accountable through a peer review process. And finally, the notion of proportionality. In California, the N size for our subgroups in our workbook is actually 100, which we thought was close to criminal. We actually dropped it to 20 by choice because disproportionality actually is a critical issue in California across all of our subgroups. And the reality is we are a majority-minority state. The vast majority of kids in our districts fall within a subgroup. We wanted to make sure that we were focusing deeply on them and what they and their needs. This is a look at our accountability model. We are a multiple measure accountability system. We have an academic domain that makes up 60% of our work, and that would include both performance and growth on Smarter Balance in California, and then graduation rates at the high school and persistence rates at the middle school, which is to look at the kids moving from middle school to high school and actually making sure that they are high school ready when entering the ninth grade. Then on the, we look at a group of social emotional factors that matter a lot to us as well. Chronic absenteeism. We start with culture and climate surveys that will go to parents, teachers, and students that will be part of our model. Again, the notion for us, accountability is what we think matters to us. And what kids think of their school matters to us. We want to incorporate that into what we pay attention to. Suspension expulsion rates very specifically targeted disproportionality. Then the social emotional skills, which we've made large because of the issue. But you see, actually, these are all 8%. And the reason they're all 8% is we've never done this before. So we wanted to sort of equally weight them as we figured it out. And as we get the measures in, we will then change the weighting based on what we're finding. And then English language learner redesignation rates, a critical thing in California. About a quarter of our kids are English language learners. And then special ed rates, again, disproportionate in particular, the number in California, the number of African American males and specifically that have been that are special education in a disproportionate way. So that sum total is our accountability model. And this summer will be the very first time we introduce this and give this to schools, what we call the School Quality Improvement Index. Our focus on social-emotional, as Chris sort of laid out, is sort of the combination of the intrapersonal and interpersonal. There was multiple measures I think Chris had up there you could have chosen from. Several of us, again, were in the Castle District, had done a number of this. But after lots of conversation, these five seemed to jump out to us as the right place to begin. What I would really want to emphasize as we look at this is that we view this as a grand pilot. We're trying to figure this out. And so we want to sort of move slowly with what we know we can do and work with and then move beyond that. So I think in hopefully 10 years from now, that would not be the total look at what we're considering. But as we begin, we thought those five in particular made a lot of sense for us to begin our work. And this is the group of folks that are working where we're doing these and which grades. And the folks helping us, most of these folks are key partners, our advisors to Transforming Education, who are our advisors in this work. And so they've sort of helped us think through how to think about this and how to consider this in our work. So we are now in the process of actually surveying about 500,000 kids. And we like to say this is the biggest pilot of social-emotional skills ever in the history of the galaxy. Planet, what do we go with? Galaxy. We're going with galaxy. No one's ever said that's not true, so we're just keeping going with it. The Martians welcome this degree. But so this is a huge undertaking for us. For the most part, we tested last year with both testing both teachers and students. So we would ask the students several questions about their social-emotional skills and ask teachers their thoughts. What we found was where we asked teachers, it was actually more helpful, and that was our best data source. But continuing that is actually very, very hard. So it was costly, and most of our districts in the pilot paid teachers to do that work but couldn't at scale continue to do it. And it got caught up in a lot of cases in our bargaining agreements. They have to – it's part of our CBAs, has to include it. So it's a very hard issue to do locally. I'm happy to say that Fresno Unified is the one district that has said wall-to-wall, every teacher in those grades will be looking at their students. The one thing you also have to understand about this, when we ask teachers to do this, you think about a secondary teacher. If you're asking a secondary teacher to ask three or four questions about every student she has in her classroom, right, you have 120, 150 sometimes kids that come across in their classrooms. It's an enormous burden. So trying to figure out how we work with the need and desire for that data, with the practical implications of how hard that is to collect locally, is something we're struggling with and trying to figure out. So we're glad that one district is doing it at scale, and then other districts are, and pilot base is going to continue to have teachers in certain classrooms do it, but all students across our entire network will be taking these, or are in the process of taking these survey items, or most actually have completed this point. And so then we are going to produce that this year, give them the initial results. One thing we were absolutely adamant on is that we never give a school data and hold them accountable before they've seen it. So this year, this summer, they will get the results of these surveys. They will get the results of where it would look normally on their index, but they wouldn't be held accountable for it next year. So the 16-17 school year will be the first year we actually will hold them accountable for these results. And then this is a look at ultimately how we're going to produce our index. And the notion is we're really trying to get away both in the federal and state accountability model from a single number. Like in California, we actually have an academic performance index that gives you a number between 2 and 800 or 2 and 1,000, 800 being your desire, or AYP, you made it or you didn't make it. So this is a we actually stole in part from Alberta, Canada, or the theory behind this of a sort of a multiple measure dashboard that gives parents a look across the board at multiple things we're considering and how your school is doing. So this is a mock. The data's fake. The mock may not look exactly like this, but we're actually working with great schools to see if we can use their sort of growth and work with them to produce a measure like this so parents can have a better understanding of what's going on in school, recognizing that a single number doesn't really capture what's happening in school and that social emotional will be a huge part of that process. So that is the overview of our work and what we're trying to do. I appreciate your time. Look forward to questions as we move forward. And at this point, I'd like to ask Richard Barth, to come and talk a little about KIPP.
So this is great. I have to say, listening to our last two speakers, I feel like we're about to enter the minor leagues. I'm not a researcher. I'm not a policy guy. I've not worked in a large system. And so, I want to, share a little bit of a story, but with immense amounts of humility, and just say the most important thing for me and the reason I came here was, I think in an organization like ours, and when people think about KIPP, they could end up, and a lot of this work saying, well, you guys must be about academics and we're talking about something different over here. And if there's one thing I hope people take away by virtue of joining you here today, it's that that's just not the case. And so I start actually just saying, what is KIPP as a reminder to us? Because if you look at the last word in the description of what we're about preparing young people for success in life. And just, as Chris and Rick spoke, I think it gets at the heart of this, which is we are not, our mission, our purpose, our reason for being in building this network is not to get a certain score on PARC this year. It's actually to prepare young people for success in life. And that has been true from day one. Now, we've grown a good bit over the last stretch. We now are, as you heard in Marty's introduction, we have 162 schools today. We're serving around 60,000 children, grades pre-K through 12. More important to us than our growth is that we have really honored this commitment to preparing kids for success in life. To this point, over 94% of our KIPPsters have graduated from high school. We now have 6,000 KIPPsters in college as we speak today. We have another 3,500 who are seniors getting ready for that next year. We view college, just to be clear, as one of the best proxies in America today to putting yourself on a pathway to success. We don't exist because we think college is not our mission in life, but we think it's still one of the best pathways. So the question we are grappling with is, how do we ensure we deliver on this promise we make to kids all across the country? Now, you could look at our 60,000 KIPPsters as we know them and love them, and you could look at the story of KIPP more broadly and say, well, it must be, again, all about just teaching and learning and academics. And so I do want to emphasize that since the beginning, if you went back to the earliest days of Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin teaching fifth grade in Houston, like at the core of KIPP was this belief we're going to work hard and be nice. Literally, if you go back and look at the original artifacts and the discussions about what we were actually doing with 47 fifth graders, there was this belief that character and academics both matter, and one doesn't matter differentially than the other, that they're equal. It's interesting looking at Rick's, looking at a dashboard, if you want to think about it as a dashboard, from it is in our DNA that these are mutually reinforcing. I want to be clear about that. This is who we've been from the very beginning. And it was with the passage of time that this belief has only been reinforced. In 2011, we stepped back and looked at all of our Kipsters. We track every single Kipster from eighth grade on. We don't lose track, you know, of what's going on in their life. And we put out this report on how they were actually doing. And everyone who knew our Kipsters, who at this point then we're talking about looking at young people are now 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24 years old, we're looking at how are kids doing, and specifically how were individuals we knew as sixth graders and seventh graders doing. And what was clear to people without a big research base was this wasn't simply a story of academics. So if you go back to the original thinking of Mike and Dave, this belief that it wouldn't just be academic potential that would dictate how you were doing in life was coming true. And we came out of looking at all of our original Kipsters, now, you know, 45% of whom have BA degrees. And we said, what was differentiating the ultimate outcomes? And we came to believe, again, academics matters deeply. So I just want to emphasize, huge, right? We got our kids have to be prepared to a high bar. But we also recognized college counseling mattered immensely. We needed to do a much better job of that. And yes, we recognized that our investment in developing strong character really mattered. So this was going on. It was always part of Kip's DNA. I just want to emphasize getting us to this point. Now we've got adults, young adults, and we're saying, wow, it is just reinforcing what we believed all along. At the same time that was going on, Dave Levin, one of our founders, started actually tapping into the research community, which you all heard about. So I don't want, you know, the last person to speak, one of your risks is always, well, I could mention the same researchers. But these are the giants in this work that we've been working with closely for several years now. So we began looking at the work, you know, you think about Marty Seligman and Pete Peterson and this field they pioneered of positive psychology, Carol Dweck on growth mindset. You see, you know, Walter Mischel with the work he done with the delayed gratification and the marshmallow research. I want to be clear. This was always inside our belief. We need to be focused on these things just as we're focused on reading and math. We're then looking at our oldest Kipsters and saying, hey, when we look at who's making it and who isn't, it is not just about who had the high reading score in eighth grade. That's a correlation, but it's not the only correlation. And then we began seeing there were whole researchers that we could start connecting to. And so through that work with Seligman and Peterson, we ended up narrowing down based on their research. They'd identified 24 key strengths that predicted lifelong success. Now, you saw in prior slides, people use different words. You know, these are the ones that we zeroed in on at KIPP. 7 key strengths, research-based, that are highly predictive of lifelong success and fulfillment. One of the things I always say, you know, when I look at these pictures, is I realize, like, most of you, this is intuitive. So one of the funny things about people want this to be either or, I can't just say it enough. Do you need to learn how to really read complex text to be, you know, able to make it in today's economy? You do. Does self-control matter? Absolutely. Are these things at opposites? Any parent would tell you, hopefully not. Right? These are very practical issues. So what is curiosity? Curiosity is this passionate interest in asking lots of questions, digging for deeper understanding. Zest. I mean, people who get passionate for a topic. In fact, it's contagious for others. And the one that everyone loves to talk about these days, grit. You know, when you think about how do you handle setbacks? And again, anyone who's a parent in this room knows this is a big part of your life working with your children. How do they actually handle setbacks? Those setbacks are guaranteed. How you handle them is the work ahead. So, you know, I look at this, you hear, you know, this great discussion today, and I have to think at some level you say, well, where do you take this? Like, from a practical standpoint, what the heck would KIPP do? Because this was part of our DNA. It was a belief system. It was permeating our schools. We're tracking our kids over time. We're recognizing we were right to care about these things, whether you call them non-cognitive, whether you call them character. We were right to care about them. The research base is emerging. How could we become more intentional about this, more systematic, from the standpoint of our schools? And so we started looking at this and said, with Marty Seligman at Penn and Angela, we said, we think that the key here is going to be creating positive institutions through which this work can flow. And there's a couple components to this this is very real time, we're working on this, but we began to see that schools are institutions, just like your family's institution, just like a church can be an institution. There's so many institutions. And we said, well, if we think this research is clear and our own experience tells us important, we can get more intentional about schools as institutions that are positive ones. PERMA, I'm not an expert in it. You know, I defer to our team that's focused on this, but it's speaking to positive emotion, engagement, relationships. I'm trying to remember what M is, and A is accomplishment. And the goal here is that you actually step back and say, how does the school deliver on what we think will actually allow for the development of these strengths? Macro structures, fancy word. Let me make it simple. I was just at our school in Northeast this morning. A macro structure in a school is, what do you do with your morning meetings? Right? A macro structure in a school is, what happens in your student government? There are structures that you can build into your, in our case, schools, into an institution that have the opportunity to be incredibly intentional and deliberate about building these strengths. And our, my big, you know, takeaway here is that we miss these opportunities all the time in life. So the question for institutions like a school is, do you identify the macro structures that intentionally are devoted to building these strengths, and do you leverage them? An example of missed opportunities, all that happens everywhere across the country every day. Think about someone who's coaching a basketball team, a football team, a soccer team. They have all these incredible opportunities to reinforce these character strengths, but they've actually not been brought into the work of the school. So they are missing in that macro structure the opportunity to be explicit about things like grit or curiosity or gratitude. Now think about it when you're intentional. I was in a morning meeting this morning with four-year-olds, and the opening discussion is gratitude. What are you grateful for today? And every child is talking about what they're grateful for, and they're grateful for each other. That is an intention, seizing an opportunity to make a connection. That's a macro structure. Micro moments, what are we doing with that? We're basically acknowledging that there are 20,000, we think, micro moments a day where all of this can be reinforced. So if you really believe character strengths matter, just like you really believe learning to read matters well and you want to have data on that, does your entire staff recognize these moments are happening as we sit in this room? The minute a child walks in the room, the minute a child, when a school security person taps you on the shoulder, there are moments that either push us forward in building these strengths or set us back. And if we want to create positive institutions, you've got to be committed to both identifying deliberately the macro structure opportunities, big fancy word for what are the structured things you're explicitly setting aside, and then recognizing that there are these moments that are happening every day that either reinforce the building of these strengths or actually tear them down. This is what we're training all of our leaders in. This is what we're training, because we think we have a huge opportunity to have this impact. Now, in case you wonder, do you really think we have this opportunity? Again, I just want to keep this real. We always show at KIPP this slide. And you know, this is James Baldwin. Many of you recognize him. And you know, to us, this is, at the end of the day, like, what is real? What is real? The reality is, through our work in our schools, our KIPPsters are picking up on this every day. And if we're going to be successful in building these character strengths, and if we are clear that the research ties that these are key to success in life, the number one thing our kids, our KIPPsters in our case, are going to pick up on is this. They're going to watch how the adults in the building interact with not just children, but actually interact with each other. What is visible to children, not what we say, what we do. And so, you know, my big hope today is that in joining you, you know, you hear from an organization that is absolutely committed to preparing kids for success in college and life, and whose, in some ways, our track record has been based on what you, many of you, just talk about as academic outcomes, that we are obsessed with this equally, that we think this is just as important for what's going to enable our young people to succeed. And we think about this every day because in 5 years, we're going to have 40,000 college-aged or older alums. And when I started at KIPP, there were 6,000 KIPPsters and a couple hundred in college. Today, there are 60,000 and 6,000 in college. In 5 years, there'll be 120,000 KIPPsters, 40,000 in this group. We truly believe these young people are going to change the world. Our investment in these character strengths, we think, are going to be as important as anything else we do. And so I'm excited to hear the panel take up the question of what are the implications of this from a policy standpoint? Not going to touch it. Not even going to try to go there. Just want to register that from our standpoint, having people pay attention to this absolutely matters. Thank you all for having me today.
So thank you to Chris and Rick and Richard for three excellent and remarkably well-timed presentations. Now it's my honor to invite to the stage three commentators to respond to what they heard as well as to share some of their own experiences. First, I'll be inviting up Chancellor Kaya Henderson of the D.C. Public Schools. Under her leadership since 2011, DCPS has become the fastest improving urban school district in the country. She's accomplished this through an intense focus on improving teacher quality and by launching and expanding a range of innovative programs to increase student achievement, including a number that explicitly target students' non-cognitive development, as we'll hear about today. Next, we'll hear from John King. He's the senior advisor, the senior advisor delegated duties of Deputy Secretary of Education, which is a title that tells you everything you need to know about Washington, D.C., at the moment. Prior to his arrival at the department, King served as the Commissioner of Education for the state of New York as the first African-American and Puerto Rican to serve in that role. And before that, he was the co-founder and co-director for curriculum and instruction at Roxbury Prep Charter School in Boston, which remains one of the highest performing charter schools in the country. And finally, we'll hear from Russ Whitehurst. Russ is a senior fellow here at the Brookings Institution, and before that, was the founding director of the Institute of Education Sciences, where he made an important and hopefully enduring impact on the really rigor and relevance of education research funded by the federal government. So I will invite them all to the stage and invite them to speak for 5 minutes or so in the order they were introduced.
Good morning. My name is Kaya Henderson. I'm the chair. College. I was actually thinking about.
Okay, we're on. We're doing a lot of the things that are best practice in this field, everything from tools of the mind, which is in 45 of my 50 elementary schools, developing executive function for our youngest learners, to things like advisory programs in our middle grades, AVID programs, Class Dojo everywhere, including on my phone for my kid, so I know what's going on at all times. We also do the Brainology work out of Carol Dweck's work in a number of our schools and are seeing incredible results. And even in our large district-wide goals, we have five big goals for the district. Student satisfaction is one of our most important goals because we think that our students being happy is as important as our students being successful. And so I guess, you know, panels are only, or commentators and panels are only interesting when there's a little disagreement. So I'll start by saying I clearly think that non-cognitive skills are incredibly important. The question that I would ask is whether or not they are an end in and of themselves or whether they're a means to an end. And I think, I don't know that I have a definitive answer, but I think there's a danger if we treat non-cognitive skills as an end in and of themselves that people will ignore the really hard work of academics that all of my colleagues clearly said is very important and just focus on the social and emotional skills. I talk to teachers all the time who are struggling, really struggling on the academic and instructional front. And they say, if I just had more social and emotional help. And sometimes that is a clear assessment of the situation. A lot of times it's not. And so my worry is that it becomes an input type of thing as opposed to an outcomes type of thing, and people begin to focus too much on that. I think my second thought about the conversation is whether or not this is new thinking or whether or not teachers and schools have actually been doing this all along and we just didn't have a fancy name for it, or we didn't have the research base for it, or what have you. Some of the behavior management systems, some of the social and emotional strategies are things that we've seen since I was a young person or any of you were young people, but they didn't have an organizing framework, or they didn't have an app, or they didn't have a company that was selling them to school districts. And I think one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves, I will tell you very honestly, in probably what is the shrine of policy, that education policy scares the mess out of me. Because I think sometimes we think a little too hard and a little too deeply about things that then get, I guess, perverted in the practical execution. And so I actually wonder whether or not our concentration in the policy realm on hardcore academics, on disaggregating data, on math and reading, has taken us away and told teachers not to focus on these things that they used to focus on alongside of academics. And now I think we might be seeing a pivot back to things that we told teachers were not important because we really wanted to drill down on hardcore academics, right? And this is when teachers go crazy, right? Because they're like, wait a minute, I was doing this kind of stuff before, and you told me all that mattered were my test scores, right? And now you're telling me that, you know, I need to also pay attention to non-cognitive skills. And I think that's when policy and practice actually are at their worst. So I'm worried. And then I guess ultimately I would say I also worry about non-cognitive skills in accountability systems. Now, I say that a little bit as a hypocrite because as I looked at the core framework, we've got a dashboard that looks like that. It's called SPIDEY, which stands for something or another. But we look at all of these different dimensions of non-cognitive measures when we set goals with principals. But I really worry when these things become accountability measures and like hardcore goals, that then things get, then things aren't implemented the way they need to be implemented. And I think teacher evaluation is a really good example of that. We all know that teacher evaluation is good and right and necessary. But as we've looked at how teacher evaluation has evolved over the course of some of the accountability work that has been done around it, I think there have been gross perversions of what it's supposed to be. And so I worry about the accountability space around non-cognitive skills. So my hope is that we give ourselves time to see some of these early projects through. I think from a policy perspective, what I would hope for is that we would watch, we would disseminate best practices, but we wouldn't rush to an accountability solution around this, because I think it's going to take us some time to settle into the right balance between non-cognitive skills and how we measure them, and how we avoid people, you know, swinging that way versus the other way. Ultimately, I think this is all about balance. We have to do both and, as Richard said, and I think in our quest for silver bullets, we run from one side to another side. And I guess I just don't trust us right now to get to the happy middle around this. So I would caution us to move very slowly and very carefully.
So I'll try to pick up where Kaya left off. So I think I was telling a friend of mine about this panel, and he said, oh no, is there going to be a bureaucracy of non-cognitive skills? And so I hope not. So I think what proceeding carefully means, at least from our perspective at the department, is trying to give districts and states, like the core districts, the flexibility through the waiver process to experiment in this area and to figure out what works in supporting schools and helping students develop non-cognitive skills. Two, to try to support good research, whether it's through the Institute of Education Sciences, through our Investing in Innovation program, through our First in the World program, which focuses on higher education, to invest in initiatives that try to leverage non-cognitive skill development to get better outcomes in terms of high school graduation, college completion, academic outcomes, so forth. So we want to be humble about the role that the federal government can play here and thoughtful about the role that we can play. A few cautions about the conversation so far. So one worry I have, which builds on something that Kaya warned about, is that the phrase non-cognitive skills or the notion of socio-emotional learning could become an excuse not to do academic work that students desperately need, or an excuse to blame students for their failure when what they're really missing is academic skills. Right, the student who's sitting at a community college a short distance away from here in a remedial math class, yes, non-cognitive skills will help, but they're not going to grit their way out of not knowing how to do basic operations with whole numbers. Right, so we've got to make sure that as we do this work that we are thinking about how we connect the non-cognitive with supporting students academically, that they don't become a distraction. Similarly, when we look at students who are struggling in high school and college, there are lots of factors, some of which are under their control, some of which aren't. And again, we just have to be careful that we don't end up blaming students for factors that are outside of their control. We can't ignore the crises around violence in the community or a parent who's a substance abuser or domestic violence in the home or a student who can't just afford to buy books for college. And so we've got to tackle as a society those things as well. A second caution is that just telling teachers do more non-cognitive stuff is inadequate to the challenge. And part of what we've got to do is figure out how do we support teachers in the concrete actions in the classroom that can support both academic success and non-cognitive skill development. A few examples. And I was a high school history teacher, so you'll have to forgive me taking advantage of the opportunity to get into the classroom level. But I think there's a lot of important work that happens at the classroom level. So if a teacher provides specific praise, that is better than the teacher who just says, you did a good job. Right? If the teacher can help the students see that it was that you wrote a strong thesis statement, that I liked how you struggled at the beginning of this project, but then you persevered to the end. I liked how you, when you got the first part of this math problem wrong, you went back, you changed it, and then you persevered through to the end of the problem. Specific praise rather than just good job, great job, is very important and is a skill that teachers can develop and that our teacher trainings should support. A second example is around writing. We know many students, when they get to college, struggle with writing. The drafting process, the process of working through a draft, getting feedback on that draft, revising that draft, supports the kind of non-cognitive skill development that we're talking about, but is, again, something that can be taught to a future teacher. Similarly, teachers can learn to construct activities and help students develop strong interpersonal skills. Right? You can develop a project in which students have different roles and their work together on the project produces a better outcome. That's a teachable skill. And so we've got to make sure that we support teachers in developing these kinds of skills. A third caution is around neglecting the role of race and class and gender in this conversation. So I'm going to add another strand to the research conversation. Claude Steele has done a lot of work on the notion of stereotype threat, that when students come into the classroom, there's very solid research on this, when students come into the classroom, if they know that there is a certain stereotype about their performance, imagine female students in an advanced mathematics course or African-American students entering into a college where they know many of their classmates are not like them, first-generation students. Those students may have a set of assumptions about how they're viewed by the institution, and so when they get a bad grade, they internalize that as confirming the stereotype. Right? We know from Claude Steele's work that that stereotype threat can easily be activated by things that are said in the classroom by the teacher or institutional messages. Similarly, helping students to overcome that stereotype threat, showing them that they can succeed, show teachers communicating their faith and confidence that students can do well, can help to overcome stereotype threat. And we sometimes in our culture, I think, are reluctant to have conversations where race and class and gender are squarely on the table, and it would be a mistake in this discourse to do that. A final sort of cautionary note is around data elements, that we have to be very careful that we, as we try to pick intended outcomes, that we pick really good ones and not ones that actually people can game or easily show progress on that actually are irrelevant to our intended long-term outcome. Figuring out which things are leading indicators, which things are the right long-term outcomes in this work, I think is complicated, and we should approach it with humility.
I'm pleased to be here. Per my introduction, I'm a researcher, so I'm going to probably say the same things my colleagues have said here, but get at it from a slightly different perspective. But I want to start with a question for you. So let's focus on the Western world, and you tell me today what country or group of countries are thought to be the most pacifist, the most focused on social justice. So what would that be? Scandinavia. All right. Now let's cycle to the 10th century. And what are the Scandinavians called then? They're called the Vikings, the baddest guys on the planet, right? So, you know, if you're in England, the Vikings are coming. The Vikings are, you were going to be dead shortly thereafter. So what's my point? My point is that certainly culture and environment shape behavior. To the extent that over a few centuries, the whole nature of a group of people can change based on changing circumstances. Now, a story for you. I don't remember how old I was. I think I was a teenager, and I was riding around town in a car with my mother. This was a small southern town. She was not particularly well-educated. We were just talking. And she pointed out the Alligood's house up there. She said, you know, they're really smart people. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, look at the house. Everything about it is meticulous. You know, the grounds are perfect. It's painted. It's in good repair. They planted stuff all around. And I'm thinking about that in the context of the Vikings. What she was saying was that in the culture in which she grew up, hard work was smart. That's what made a difference. And the stuff that I was interested in, grades in school, wasn't relevant very much in her culture. So I would ask you to think about the Vikings and the people in the small town in which I grew up, and I would ask you, were the Vikings maladjusted in some way? They were not. they were supremely adjusted to the circumstance in which they found themselves. So I think we need to be very careful about identifying particular characteristics of people as somehow inherently good or inherently bad. They're very much adjusted to circumstance, and we need to create environments in which adjustment flows to everybody's public good, not to narrow goods that, disrupt the rest of society. Now, let me put on my researcher hat for just a minute and go to the malleability question. It's been raised previously. It's very important as we get into this space that we focus on characteristics that can be changed by school environments rather than characteristics that cannot. I'm a psychologist by training. Psychologists have been looking at personality traits now for at least 75 years. Something called the Big Five traits that psychologists have agreed are there and can be measured reliably in everybody: openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. These overlap with what we're talking about as soft skills. The heritability quotient for the Big Five is extremely high. About 50% of the variance is determined by genetics. The rest of it, we don't know what it's determined by. It's mostly era. What I'm saying is that identical twins reared apart are highly similar on these traits. if we get into the business of trying, of holding schools accountable for changing these traits, we're on a fool's errand because of the high heritability. So very important to keep that in mind. We've heard some evidence this morning, and it's solid evidence of the strong predictive relationship of non-cognitive skills to later outcomes. We don't know how much of that predictive relationship is determined by non-malleable components or personality components or big five personality traits versus how much is determined by home and school. We very much need to understand that. My own bias is that we're going to do much better as we get into this space with interventions if we ask teachers in schools to teach specific skills and abilities rather than trying to modify personality traits. Making eye contact, being polite, being on time for class, having something nice to say about the work of others, doing homework, not cheating, dressing appropriately. These are things that schools can transmit as important. And I think what may emerge from that is something that looks like character and acts like character, but is not a direct attempt to teach character. We've got to be very keenly interested in learning what works and learning what works in a rigorous way. One of my big bets when I came to the Institute of Education Sciences was an investment in research called the Social and Character Development Program. We funded randomized trials of seven of the most promising school-based social and character development programs we could identify. So each was a randomized trial. Schools were randomly assigned to carry out the intervention or not. The interventions took place in fourth and fifth grade, and the kids were followed for 3 years. Multiple outcomes were measured. When you combine the programs, there were 60 impact estimates, impact being what's the difference between the control group and the intervention group. Two were statistically significant, and they had to do with the perception of teachers of the character climate in the school. There were no impacts on student behavior whatsoever, either social character development outcomes or academic outcomes. So good intentions here and nice-sounding programs don't necessarily work. We need to be very careful to find out what works going forward. And finally, I think in keeping with comments we've already heard, but coming at it again from a slightly different perspective, I want to remind those who know about it already and introduce you, if you don't know about it, to Campbell's Law. Named after Donald Campbell, a famous social psychologist. And Campbell's Law is this, quote, the more any quantitative social indicator or even some qualitative indicator is used for social decision-making, the more subject it will be to corruption pressures and the more apt it will be to distort and corrupt the social processes it is intended to monitor. We have to be very careful as we connect accountability to our interest in developing social skills, that we don't generate a system that can be gamed from an administrative perspective and can distort what kids are learning. That said, this is a new generation of work in this area. I think it has the potential of being extremely important, and I'll be certainly looking forward to the pilot efforts that we've heard about today and seeing what success they generate. Thank you.
So I'm going to invite all of the participants back to the stage now, and it looks like we have a good bit of time to engage in some question and answer. I'm going to take the prerogative as moderator to kick off the discussion. And Rick, as you get settled, I wanted to raise what I think is a common criticism of efforts to expand the measures included in educational accountability systems or to broaden the definition of educational success, one that was alluded to on the panel, which really that this is all an attempt to soften accountability for academic outcomes. How do you all at CORE respond to that, you know, potential criticism? I'm sure it's something that has come up, and I assume it's not the way you think about what you're engaged in.
We disagree?
Yeah.
Respectfully. So
I'd start by saying, if you look at our percentages, we overweight academic, right? So 60% of our weighting falls in the academic. So it's absolutely clearly something, much like Richard talked about, that we view as two sides of the coin, both matter. But we ultimately would argue that hyper-focus on a single assessment score was not effective. It did not move our systems in the way we needed to move. And we found it very interesting as we went through this that there was this AYP score, and then there was these dashboards of what districts did pay attention to, right? High-performing districts like Long Beach and Sanger and others within our networks that were very successful moving student achievement forward. And so, and there was this disconnect, I think, in our classrooms where teachers were expected to pay attention to these issues, but then told it was a distraction. And so, in a sense, I think partially what we're arguing is that schools are not as simple as a single score, that you have to pay attention to multiple measures in it. And this was our best attempt. When we look at our accountability model, our argument, again, is not what we're going to hammer you for, but if you look at all of these measures collectively, this is what makes it. If you're successful at moving these measures, you will get a student college and career ready, which is our ultimate goal. And that we have to value paying attention to these different measures and then give assistance to teachers in how to do these things in the classroom. And so that's what our argument is. And that's also, by the way, what I say why we're doing it as a pilot is we're starting slowly, figuring out, moving it along. But ultimately, you don't have the luxury of not paying attention to all these measures if you want academic achievement.
And Richard, I wanted to ask you to reflect a little bit on the conversation that's come up around malleability. So Chris suggested that that should be a key criterion when thinking about which non-cognitive traits that schools might think about focusing on, policymakers might think about focusing on. And I'd say that a lot of the enthusiasm for non-cognitive skills as a strategy for improving students' life outcomes comes from this sense that perhaps they're maybe even more malleable than are sort of other aspects of students' performance. But I think the malleability point can arguably cut both ways in the sense that any impacts on a skill that occur because of its malleability may prove to be entirely non-persistent. So how do you all at KIPP think about ensuring that what you're doing when the students are in the schools sort of stays with them as they move to college, if that's the choice they make, or into other settings?
Yep. So this is when I said I'm beyond my pay grade. Let me take a crack at just what I think our experience is. And actually, I thought the panel discussion was great and raised the right questions. You'll see that I didn't put up here a scorecard, an accountability system. We too have a balanced scorecard for KIPP. This actually is not. We think these actually flow through these long term outcomes, but we don't have an accountability system that's wrapped around it. Here's what I would say we've seen. So one is, and this isn't at the level that we described in terms of research, but we spend a lot of time with our alums. In fact, IDEO is working with our alums right now, and they've just been spending a lot of time meeting with them. And let me just say, like, if two things come out of it when I sat listening to the actual voices of alums right now, it's that there are signature experiences that actually they draw upon that get them through their challenges. And it's about their connection to teachers who shaped their belief that they could do this. And so I'm listening to 24-year-olds talk about what happened in fifth grade, and I remember my teacher kept saying, you're going to climb the mountain, you're going to climb the mountain. And every time there were these moments where she had doubt, they would work through it. Now, that does not pass the hardcore research test. But what I would say is, just as a human being, is it is clear to me that what John talked about in terms of teacher professional development and investing in teachers, there's huge amounts of low-hanging fruit out there where we do not have to look at these in conflict. And actually, our teachers and our leaders can understand that investing in seizing the opportunities to use what we call these macro structures and these micro moments are going to have a big impact on our kids' belief that they can do it. Which one of these we're going to find out over time, you know, hopefully with good research, are going to have the biggest basis. But I would want people to come away from this recognizing that I don't think this – I would be scared, too, if people are thinking about this as some big new thing. The real opportunity is we have low-hanging fruit in school institutions. And good schools do this all the time, which is they actually look at explicit opportunities and then all these micro moments say, are you reinforcing these elements that, based on our experience, our kids look back on and say – were absolutely material to their belief they could do that. And so I just want to last close and say, like, we are, so because, you know, we're not presenting a scorecard. I wouldn't be proposing a policy change. But I want to say, John said something about, you know, this research on race and how what young people are feeling when they're in environments. Those moments, if you're the first in your family to be in college, first, what we hear from our alums all the time is they, and I literally hear them speak to it, I hear their emails, I read, they go back to moments, you cannot believe how long back in their life, where people said, you're going to earn this, you belong. Like, they draw on those absolutely repeatedly. And so if we miss as an institution the opportunity to build those strengths, I think we've missed a huge opportunity to move beyond just whether you feel like you can make it academically. Last thing, because I don't want anyone to be confused about this. If you are not prepared academically, this does not compensate for all your for all those deficiencies. So if you're not prepared to write effectively, if you're not prepared to communicate effectively, if you don't have core basic math skills, this will not get you over all those things. It will, though, I think, in our experience, it will see for many of our kids the reason to believe they would actually persist to develop those skills. It will help them. But this is not an end-or, and it's not going to solve for real hardcore academic deficiencies that too many kids in the country have.
And one more question before we turn to the audience, and I'll start with you, Russ, but I'd also like to get Chris and anyone else who wants to weigh in. As I understand it, and it predates my involvement in education research a bit, but in the 1970s and 80s, there was a lot of talk about how schools should do more to raise student self-esteem. And there was a lot of evidence presented, not too dissimilar to what we saw presented today, showing how predictive high levels of self-esteem were over educational and life outcomes. And as I understand it, the consensus is now that efforts to promote self-esteem independently, that is to raise self-esteem as an end in and of itself rather than promoting students' underlying skills that were driving these predictive relationships, was ineffective and potentially even counterproductive. So I guess the question for you, Russ, is, am I right about that story? And if so, what should we take about away from it? And then really for anyone who wants to weigh in, are we at risk of walking down that same path currently?
Yes and yes. So those were the findings from the earlier research on self-esteem. And education is very faddish, and there is always a danger that an underlying conceptually good model gets taken over by a fad and made into something that generates unintended effects. And I think there's some danger of that here. Again, I believe that we're talking about something critically important that schools can have an impact on. But if we don't retain a skepticism, a kind of show me, a worry about what the bad things it might have, if we don't retain that, if we just go with the flow of the fad, I think there's a potential for damage.
You want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in trying to start with the data today, I think one of the things I hope to highlight is we can't ignore the fact that the data is overwhelming, that in college success and career and academic success, in career and life success and well-being, these non-cognitive factors are highly predictive of outcomes. They're probably, by the way, likely on the range of as influenceable as academic ones. We're struggling to teach literacy too. So, I mean, things that are ingrained in people are ingrained in people. And I certainly agree with Russ that some things are probably more malleable. The entire cognitive behavioral therapy field, which has revolutionized psychiatry, is all about changing things that are unbelievably hard for people to change. So, I think there's lots of reasons to be optimistic if we focus in on it. And in terms of the fad pact, one of the things that's really important for people in the policy world, I think, to hear, and I was fascinated to hear, you know, that list, Kaya, of really thoughtful programs, you know, you've rolled out. Those are, but to Russ's point, you know, going backwards, those seven IES-funded studies that showed no effects for them, many of those programs are among that $640 million a year I laid out that American education is spending and the 10% of all teacher time. So I think any notion that we shouldn't open the barn door, what might come out, hey, folks, the barn door is way wide open. The real problem is there's zero information in scale about whether it's helping kids. So if you ask people in classrooms, and it's fascinating that the two items that Russ said were, you know, positive in those trials were what teachers thought. I'm a big believer. We got to listen to teachers, and I found fascinating, Kaya, your point about what teachers say and the risks of excuses, for sure, you know, instead of the academic side. But I think we need to recognize that we need as much understanding of the hard issues of raising non-cognitive skills as we do now have, I think, about the hard challenge of raising literacy skills. And that means understanding the micro specifics of them, the role of phonemics versus the role of, you know, sight word recognition. And many of the things that we've now understand about literacy, we do not have the same vocabulary for these non-cognitive skills. And until we get about the business of intentionally collecting that kind of data and information, running the kind of experiments we have, what we're really going to have is no policy and lots of practice.
So let's turn on that note to the audience. Please raise your hand. That seems to be straightforward. We have microphones that will come to you. Please identify yourself and your organization, and remember that questions usually end in a question mark. So, yes, ma'am, right here in the front.
Hi, I'm Hillary Rhodes from the Wallace Foundation. Really interesting discussion today. I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts. One issue that hasn't really come up in earlier discussions, though, is our confidence in the measures to actually assess these skills with sufficient validity and reliability that we can rely on them as good accountability measures. I'm hoping that you can respond to that issue.
Rick, you're probably...
Actually, why don't you talk about your work with
Well, I'm very interested in this issue because my one contribution to the research on non-cognitive skills is really to show how tricky they are to measure, especially through student self-reports, that when a student tends to assess their self-control or their grit more critically, does that mean that they actually have lower levels of grit or that they held themselves to a higher standard? And it appears, based on some findings that I've produced, that it may be a bit of the latter and that schools may influence the standards that students hold themselves to. So I do admit to having some reservations about especially using self-reports as a basis for an accountability system. They're easily corruptible when stakes are attached. Nonetheless, I think I'm pleased to be working indirectly with CORE to help them pay careful attention to these issues going forward. And Rick, I don't know if you want to...
No, I would just sort of say, and again, you two are the more the experts this than I, but you know, our initial look and was encouraging that we were able to actually deal with reference bias. Again, it was better when we had teachers, when we were to triangulate, right? So we had both student and teacher multiply looking at a student, and that is clearly the ideal way to go, and ultimately probably I don't know how far we can get unless we can do that in a meaningful way. But I think we did feel that when doing that, we were confident that we're moving in the right direction, is the best I could say, with the limited pilot we did.
Yes, sir. And right on the aisle here.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. I'm retired. And I have a comment and a quick question. The comment is maybe looking at big data will help a lot of these problems. There's a book out, Social Physics by Pentland, that may be relevant for a lot of this work. And the question is for Richard, how successful are those who did not go to college?
So, we are still early in this because our kids are not – we have small numbers of folks who are at an age where you'd say we can make a determination of how successful they are. What we know right now, it's pretty clear, is our kipsters who are graduating from college are on better trajectory. So for all those who say, like, are there good – is it really that material? For our kids and our alums, those who've gone to college are feeling stronger about – their place in the world, their economic well-being, the opportunities ahead of them, even when they have debt. So I would want to be clear, like even though they do have debt and everyone's talking about these days, nothing about our experience so far would have us advising young people who really are in a position to go to college not to do it. And I think there's a lot of work to do, you know, by us, but by everyone, to get far better at at understanding what the alternative paths are that really work. Because in most of the places where we do our work, right, those paths are not that well articulated. So the real – this is something Kai and I have talked about. Like the real clear articulation of if you do this, here's the opportunities that people like to talk about. When you go to Chicago or you go to New Orleans or you go to, Oklahoma City, they're just not that well mapped out. So I'd love to think there are those pathways, but there's a lot of work to do site by site, not by kit by everyone, to make them real.
And just a brief interjection on the big data point. I think that is actually where a lot of the most interesting activity around measurement is heading, trying to take advantage of information that schools may already have, be collecting, even if they're not tracking it systematically, things like absences, merits, and demerits in a way that might allow you to make inferences about students' non-cognitive or character development. The challenge there is that the more you go in the direction of a concrete behavior, the further away you are from an underlying construct that you can think about developing interventions to improve. But one of the things I took away from Russ's remarks is that maybe that is the level at which we should be focusing, and that becomes a more intriguing possibility. Yes, ma'am, in the front row. Go ahead.
My name is Li Yang. Thanks for your presentation, especially the expert commentary, and your concern is very important. And I want to change the angles. I think if a good teacher can teach, they usually combination with a good teaching skill plus their own non-cognitive skill. So, and Li, just kind of by example, is very important for the students. And also for the student portion is when the student have a good family care and teachers loving care plus their family environment, that would be very important for their not only their social skill development but also their concentration of studies. So I think if we can emphasize our main priority task, how to change your students' environment and the teacher's quality is more important. Why we separate out the cognitive skill, non-cognitive skill. I think non-cognitive skill, what that means, is very important, but it should be built in the quality of teachers and then also the environment of family of the students. So if we can do this, my question is, if we can sort of change our priority and concentration and emphasize non-cognitive skill to the teachers and change the students' environment, that would be wonderful.
Richard, that reminds me of the point you made with the James Baldwin quote. Kai, I wonder if you could talk about the way in which you think about that in terms of selecting or developing your teachers' capacities.
Yeah, I mean, I think Richard's point was absolutely right, and I think one of the big missing pieces on the panel is a school of ed, right, and what implications this has for a teacher education, right? I mean, she's absolutely right. If we actually believe that the best way to teach kids is by putting the right examples in front of them, then this conversation would have the most impact at the teacher training level, not at the how do we fix our kids level. And one of the challenges that I have around some of the character programs that I've seen come through our doorstep are that they seek to displace character values that a family might have, right, in exchange for some other inherently good values. And I think that's a recipe for disaster. And I think, as Russ suggested, we just can't do. And so I think the best way to avoid those kind of sticky wickets is to put great teachers who model the kind of behavior, the kind of character and non-cognitive skills that we want in front of kids, so that kids then learn that way. But I think, you know, ultimately we're having this conversation because, like, we, you know, teaching is an art and a science, but we have now all of this data, and so we're trying to reduce it to the scientific part of teaching, to every single element that we can then teach somebody how to do so that they can do it right. Because ultimately, we don't trust our teachers because we don't really hire the smartest people to teach. And so we have to deconstruct teaching in such a way that we can give it to them in bites and bits, and then they can do the right things, and then it'll all work out, right? And the truth of the matter is that's not track. That's not true. That's not right. We have to hearken back to the fact that some of this is imperfect. Like, we're in the people development business, and it's not all reductionist. And so I think how we cultivate the people who are in front of our young people matters a lot more than sometimes what we do with our young people.
Can I just build it up for one thing? Because I think it's one just, you know, reflection. And I was like, what am I going to do in this panel? How do I belong here? I would just say, like, here's one of my worries. One, that this whole thing gets positioned as a response to a current focus on higher standards, academic standards. Like, big mistake, right? So we got to make sure it doesn't happen. Two, and then leads to this fad thing, shop, you know, driving people crazy. Second thing, I would just say, we're almost could be in denial for what is actually happening on the ground every day. And the reality is, like, this does, before there was all the research and all the data we're looking for, teachers, parents, families, institutions we know of grapple with this very real issue every day, which is you run into specific moments with specific young people, and you're running all the things you think you know, every play you can think of, every technical thing. And the reality is, it's not working. It is not working. And so then the question is, are there other things that matter that unleash the potential of people? Anyone who's had a child knows this is true. That you just know this is true. If you're a parent, you know this is true. Anyone who's watched a kid play a sport knows this is true. Coaches work with them. You're like, why is this not happening? You could say, well, it's just because they have not figured out how to do this. Half the time, they have to get inside kids' heads to figure out what is holding them back from approaching it a new way. And so I say this because I worry, like, we could end up with people saying, well, was this a yes, no answer? And I actually think this speaks to something which is real educators, people on the ground, grapple with. If we think about something like how do you handle setbacks, this is something that everyone who hires someone would know this is going to be an important thing. And the question is, how do we actually equip teachers and institutions where teachers work to handle this more effectively? Before we even think about a data system, an accountability system, teachers need this, schools need this in order to meet their ambitions for young people.
Quickly, I think we have time for one more question from the front row here.
I'm Jean Gossman from Education Daily, and I wanted to discuss measures as well, and especially considering what Mr. King said and Dr. Whitehurst said about people's background and the sensitivity of some of these issues vis-a-vis their background and their temperament and whether or not they can change things as easily as we might like. It seems to me that this is indeed heading somewhat inexorably toward standards and measurement. And what are you going to do? I mean, once you get the indicators all worked out in X years, but it's coming closer and closer that people want this and want it now, even in the Common Core or in state standards. So, I mean, the barn door is open and the bull's out. So how are you going to rein it in and measure and have standards that won't be harmful in the immediate or medium term? Thank you.
John, you want to tackle that?
Yeah, and Russ should certainly add to this because he's played a key role in this idea. But I think we've got to be disciplined about rigorous evidence around the effectiveness of interventions. The thing we should be measuring is the long-term outcomes, and what we have, I think, in this non-cognitive work is a hypothesis about what intervention might get to a better outcome. So I'll give you an example. At the City University of New York, they have a program called ASAP. The idea is that community colleges generally have very poor graduation rates, but if you take a group of community college students and you provide them with intensive support, help them in the way to think about which courses they pick, help them advise them when they're struggling in a course, provide them with access to academic remediation, but also the sort of socio-emotional support that will allow them to persevere in college, you can get better outcomes. They did a randomized controlled trial with this ASAP program. The community college 3-year graduation rate was about 20% for the control group and about 40% for the students in the ASAP program. They didn't set out to measure, do the students at the end have more grit, perseverance, et cetera. They sought to measure whether an intervention based on a hypothesis about non-cognitive and academic supports would work. And I think we have to do the same thing here. we should test out, are there interventions around growth mindset that lead to better academic outcomes? And we should use randomized controlled trials to do that. We should test out on professional development, where we have a very weak evidence base. Are there programs that train teachers in a particular set of skills that then lead to better academic outcomes for students? But I think you're right. There is a real danger that what we do is essentialize non-cognitive to an isolatable set of skills that results in the Campbell's Law problem that Russ was describing.
We're on exactly the same page, and it is partly a big data answer. We should be measuring things that are face valid outcomes everyone should value. Do the kids actually come to school, or is there a high truancy rate? Do they graduate from high school? Do they enroll in college? Are there misbehavior referrals? These are the outcomes that I think we could agree are important and ought to be measured, and schools ought to be, or teachers, people ought to be held accountable for. If we attach accountability to a self rate, a student's rating of a teacher on the climate that created in the class, would be my thought.
Well, we are officially a couple minutes past time. This has been an extraordinarily informative discussion for me. Before you depart, I actually want to invite Chris Gabrielli up to say a few closing words. Transforming Education had a huge role in putting together this event, and I think he wants to be able to send you off and invite you to thank the panel. So.
Thank you, Marty. Well, first of all, thanks to you. It's a total pleasure to work with you. You range across policy leadership to rigorous quantitative evaluation of these things, and we're fortunate to have you. I think the quality of the panel today heartens me in terms of, I think this is a very difficult issue, and I think the cautions our three excellent panelists gave us, you know, we feel strongly at Transforming Education as well. But I also think their presence here today and their engagement on it highlights that this is a large area of both practice and policy that has a small current base of activity. And so we at Transforming Education appreciate Brookings embracing this and encourage everyone in this room to go more to this how question. How do we respect the concerns that have been raised, which we share, and yet go from large-scale practice, no policy, towards smart policy. So thanks to a fabulous set of speakers and panelists. Thanks to all the interest from the audience. And let us figure this out in the time ahead.